listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Born in Watts, Wanda Coleman witnessed Simon Rodia working on the towers firsthand. Wanda is the author of 18 books of poetry and prose. She's been an Emmy-winning scriptwriter and a former columnist for Los Angeles Times Magazine. As the Poetry Foundation noted, quote, she has created a body of work that is first of all focused on racism and that, secondly, ponders the outcast status of living below the poverty line in California, specifically her birthplace, Los Angeles. Among her many honors are Guggenheim and NEA fellowships and the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize. Her poems have been translated into numerous languages, including French, German, Spanish, and Hungarian. Her most recent books include Ostinato Vamps, The Riot Inside Me, Trials and Tremors, Jazz and 12 O'Clock Tales, and a new collection of poems, The World Falls Away, cited for its clarity, wisdom, and piercing intelligence. We also want to congratulate Wanda Coleman as the recently announced 2012 recipient of the Shelley Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America, which is pretty cool. Reading after Wanda is Lewis McAdams, who is a poet, journalist, filmmaker, and activist who has written on topics ranging from cultural history to the environment. Lewis is a Texas native, though he's made a huge impact on Los Angeles. He's the author of more than a dozen books of poetry, including the most recent, Dear Oxygen, of which Anne Waldman wrote, "McAdams' eye is sharp, his ecological consciousness astute, and he bucks the heartbreaks of modern man and takes on reclamation of the Los Angeles River." As many of you know, in 1985, Lewis founded Friends of the Los Angeles River, which he calls a 40-year artwork to bring the Los Angeles River back to life. So if you enjoy riding or bicycling on the Los Angeles River, as I do, and keeping an eye out for those great blue herons, you have Lewis McAdams to thank, and he remains the organization's president. His book, Birth of the Cool, A History of the Idea of Cool, was chosen one of the best nonfiction books of the year in 2001 by the Los Angeles Times. And Lewis and Wanda will be joined by Linnell George, who is an LA-based journalist and essayist. She was a longtime staff writer for the Los Angeles Times and the LA Weekly. She covers books, music, visual arts, social issues, and identity politics, and her work has appeared in many publications. She's currently assistant professor of English at Loyola Marymount, where she teaches journalism. In a recent and quite beautiful essay for the Los Angeles Times about her mother's books, Linnell wrote, "Talking about books, the metaphors, the layered imagery, the object lessons was at the core of our communication. When I was very young, she read those books, plucked from those precarious stacks to me, not just at bedtime, but also whenever she encountered a particularly moving passage, a mind-bending premise, or a startling turn of phrase." I think tonight we'll have the pleasure of hearing many mind-bending premises and startling turns of phrase. I was looking in Wanda's book like Houdini breakthroughs and glowing coal and vast underbellies. Please welcome first to the podium, poet Wanda Coleman. Thank you. Actually, welcome all our guests.
Good evening. Thank you for coming out. I'm going to roar through four or five pieces for you. I'm a native, as you heard, and I did about 20 years in Hollywood, so I'm going to start with something that came out of that period. Neruda, few quiet hours, I spend them soaking in the tub with my Neruda. In a dream, a bearded Moreno stranger approaches me along a dark street in the plaza. As we pass, he whispers hoarsely, "Neruda." On Sunset Boulevard, a beggar accosts me for spare change. I hand him my collected Neruda. While my lover takes siesta, I walk down to the neighborhood bar for a game of pool solo. I order dos besos, put a quarter in the juke. Notice all selections read Neruda. While standing at the supermarket checkout stand, I read tabloid headlines. One screams, "Man force feeds wife Neruda." He tells me he is worried. Neruda is coming between us. Note found in Cantonese fortune cookie. Neruda slept here. Two pieces from a collection of prose called Native in a Strange Land, and the second piece, which will be extremely abbreviated, actually cost me a literary prize. It's very interesting because when critics review books of prose and fiction, they always compliment the author for sounding poetic, but it doesn't happen the other way around. So I was playing with a lot, being a fusionist. I call myself being a jazz fusionist when I wrote that essay. So you'll hear a little bit about it. You'll hear a little bit of it. And this is just a little sort of footnote piece. Got the K-K-G-O jazz obituary for you, Frank. Traffic jamming into L.A. from the valley. You were gone, found the next eternity behind the wheel of your scruffy Volkswagen parked at the curb. All I ever heard about you was the bad news. The singer, ex-wife, live-in lovers, and blonde Golden State taxi dispatcher. I didn't want to know anything except that night at Pasquale's in Malibu when you slew the room. It was Ray Pizzi's show, but after the climax, it was your ear everyone wanted to whisper in. All I ever heard about was the chipping bouts with the needle, and I didn't want to know you except for the drums. And I saw you levitate souls once, and recall that time you came over to visit me and my ex and sat across from us and smoked buku jays and made with the jive chit-chat. And one day, you and I got mean together, and I had to cuss you out of my house. Although, I did go hear you romance those drums at Jazz Safari in Long Beach. And some nights we'd radio in and catch you on a cool old cut in the cold AM and B moved. Yeah, Frank. Regards, Mr. Butler. Regards, Mr. Butler. Frank Butler. You know, that night, a rich young Japanese man rose out of the audience and offered him a blank check if he would teach him the drums. Quite a night. When the LA Times reviewed it, they barely mentioned his name. L.A. Love Cry. Who loves Los Angeles is Los Angeles. The gospel according to Saint who? But to love this turf is to love hard and unrequited. It's to be a constant trick, a constant victim of the dry screw. It's to never be quite satisfied on deeper levels. It's to always be hungry for the sweet loved promise by a city with no center, no heart, no soul, and legendary for it. A glitter queen with 5 o'clock shadow whose lovers don't care what sins have been committed. They keep coming back for more. Loving you. Loving you, babe, won't you spread those wings for me? Loving you is an S&M trip. You gave birth to me, and while I love you for that, I hate you for the painful afterbirth. I hate you because you are never the same twice in the same day. You are constantly somewhere else. You are constantly someone else, loving your horizons while hating your gutters, loving your chaotic sprawl, yet hating to share you with others, jealous of your ethnic diversity, yet drunk with the perfume of sweats that assault the nose, hating your racism, loving your outsiders, your street racers, dragsters, lowriders, cruiser bruisers, cowboys, and crip dogs. The lonely who find solace traversing freeway interchanges. The lonely who drive slowly seeking the answer in shadowy doorways, off alleys, on gas station service lots after closing. The lonely who get off on eyes found only in the dark corners of certain clubs. Loving your money potential, loving your fame potential, hating the way you make a sucker pay and pay and pay and pay for a slice of the dream that is never delivered, hating the way you steady pump up for the seduction. Yeah, I'm bleeding for you, LA. You're hot, you're too damn cold to love. You are one long, relentless drive nowhere, sometimes in circles, always in heavy traffic. Gridlock is a state of mind. You hurt me when the jazz went down. Black music has always had to go blow to blow to make it. And the transmigration of the soul into sterile beauty left me longing for loves that have butterfly wings, mood indigos, and the mellow, smoky vibratos of two cool DJs kicking in Saturday night grooves from Miles to Masekela. Loving you is a special brand of madness, as sweet, as spicy, as dangerous as clove. Loving you is to embrace the irrational and the disarranged, is to welcome halfway house refugees and hospice hangers-on, is spreading joy among the homeless lining corporate buildings with their possessions of cast-offs, soaking up the remaining sun captured in the mortar. Loving you is to love fast food. Loving you is to eat with one hand while maneuvering the steering wheel with the other, working the armrest. Loving you is to embrace violence in broad daylight in South Central. To love LA is to love more than a city. It's to love a language, to do lunch or done deals or do the do, and there ain't much in the way of Duende. It's to love accents that change as swiftly as the street lights. To love LA is to worship in the temple of skin, every shade from milk to jet black. People don't wear clothes, they wear images, they costume. To love you, LA, is a never-ending bitch. You treat me bad as deeply as I love you, you abuse me, you misuse me, you continually whop me upside the head. You constantly bust me for being faithful and say I'm a fool to expect gratitude. LA, to love you is to have my heart split open without the possibility of mending. You hurt me again and again, and yet I still can't leave you, still can't put you down. Your 9 commandments of love. 1, thou shalt not get old. 2, do unto others before they do you. 3, thou shalt not yield right of way. 4, thou shalt honor thy real estate and insurance agents. 5, madness is method and mediocrity is profit. 6, high profile talks, low profile walks. 7, the lacking in horsepower shall inherit the dust. 8, what can't be sold is of no value. 9, make believe is the only reality. Well, this is an excerpt. The story takes place in the Los Angeles of the of 1943. Two couples are driving from the Wilshire area into South Central. And suddenly, everyone has a gripe about this and that and what. What about it? There's two couples. The older couple, the gentleman is driving, his wife is pregnant, and the second couple are newlyweds in the back seat. Suddenly, it is about time this took place and that was brought out in the open. And what decent folk do to change whatever it is. Suddenly, everyone is edgy and hungry again. Suddenly, everyone is in a hurry to get back to the house, get out of the clothes they've worn all day, kick back, put up their feet. Suddenly, everyone's exhausted. The newlyweds fall into a doze. Suddenly, the pregnant wife taps her husband's arm and points. Ahead, there is an object in the middle of the street, a gunny sack. If it is a sack, she thought she saw it move. Please go around it, she asks. Is she out of her ever-loving, cotton-picking mind? The tension radiates from his hands into and out of his mouth. The blast of unearned fury scorches her heart, and she whispers damnation under her breath, remembers the new life she carries, leans into the armrest and closes her eyes. Her withdrawal incites him, and he taps the accelerator. Disturbed by the vibrations, the newlyweds force themselves into alertness, having only half heard the spat. Over some kind of bag in the middle of the road, the radio is broadcasting Jesse Jazz now, a hot and heavy finger snap and swing. The rhythm boys are burning under the slide trombone. The newlyweds syncopate as they speculate while the vehicle races forward. A wind-tossed garment, rags and tatters from some blue heaven, a medicine bag dropped by the local hoodoo man, love letters from a soldier overseas, spuds abandoned by some footwear-y shopper, apples from under an old apple tree, mittenless kittens nobody has the courage to drown. There's a split-second lull in the music when impact is imminent. The lull is filled with an infant's spasmodic scream. The mental sanctuary of their shock is violated as the brass section pours it on and the trumpet player shrill wail is nearly drowned in the slam of brakes and the shriek of tires. A poem for you on cleaning up all these ashes in the sand. Poem in 16 parts. What if I told you Rappaccini also had a son? Would you believe me? During Indian summer 1955, I decided to live life sideways, head pointing to Manhattan, heart in the West. My father takes me to Disneyland. He tells me America rises from a sea of blood. Learn to cry while you laugh. When I was a teenager, I was mother's helper. I disappeared from the kitchen to make history. What is the difference between revolution and resolution? None. I learned retard intonation with a Dixie twang. Colorism makes clowns of us all. I taught Malcolm X how to fix a hex. Not everyone loves fingering on improper pianos. A lifetime of playing to empty auditoriums ignites a raging fire of intellect and verbosity. Diane Arbus lent me her eye. I consulted my I Ching and found a world missing. White teeth and a big smile. Melodrama rides my tongue. Fame made me an unknown woman. I don't get paid for describing misery. I don't get paid. Let me explain about Mammy Wada. That will tell you why I'm here and not there. How long will I survive Los Angeles? I'm holding my breath. Keep counting. Connubial love is a slow roast over hot wood while dancing from a noose. No escape. Mother died 3 years ago. She has been trying to reach me in her sleep. There is no poison. I have not swallowed. There is no poison. I have not swallowed. I have known blackness.
The hell am I going to follow that? Well, let's see. About a year and a half ago, a woman came into my life that changed the rules and changed the roles. And this poem is dedicated to her tonight. It's called Bina. The dark mother, the state of total form, is called by some mercy, by some love. Abraham's tent opened in all directions to contain whatever was lifted by the good right hand of God. Beauty, wisdom, balance, karma, death or victory, all the kingdoms of splendor grew in his head like the tree of life that Abraham watered every morning, waiting for the woman who would be his wife. As some people here know, I've spent a long time working on the LA River, and I feel like I finally drowned in it, and which I think I was aiming for all at the time. And this is because I think, I imagine this audience is people that know something about politics. I don't really know why I think that, but I bet it's true. And so this poem is about politics. It's called To Stand With Wu. I took Tory down to the riverbank so that we could stand in a semicircle behind mayoral candidate Mike Wu as he announced his urban environmental program from behind his solar-powered lectern. Afterwards, Wu came up to me and I introduced him to Tory, who I was holding in my arms. Tory buried his head in my shoulder as Wu tried to lean into his face and greet him eye to eye. Wu's head appeared to balloon, sailing his voice downstream toward Vernon, where the blood from the Farmer John's slaughterhouse is splashed on the river's concrete walls. The next night, as I strolled into the quiet polling place across the street from the Silver Lake Reservoir, I was still trying to decide whether to vote for Wu, who'd been tapped by what was left of Mayor Tom Bradley's coalition, or Nick Patsouris, who was pushing a visionary urban platform of his own and still carrying Tory. I shifted him from arm to arm as I stepped into the booth with my ballot to punch out one or another of the candidates' holes. Who should I vote for, Tory? I wondered, still unable to decide. Woo, said the 2-year-old without hesitation. Vote for Woo! I knew this was a political crowd. On Pennsylvania Avenue, Tender-budded mammals, skateboarders in baggy baggies and extra-large tees, 360 into the face of General Ulysses S. Grant. Even as a statue, you can tell he was a hard drinker. Mean as a culvert full of street water after the first rain. After the endless supplications to the senators, the thumb drives, the skulls, and the shelves, everything was there left to remind me that after everything changes, everything remains the same. So why can't I be just a little less impatient? The American flags whip me like photo ops in the spring bluster. I study the faces of lovers for a clue to something I can take back with me to my hotel. Don't be shy, guy, a hooker coos from the statue of Edmund Burke, who wrote that the Tree of Liberty is watered with our patriotic blood. But I don't feel shy. I feel poisoned, scourged, the citizen of a penal colony. I set out to be a hero and a legend, and I ended up a lobbyist. That's a tragic poem. You know. Well, it is for me anyway. This is called To Artesia. And to those of you who worship various gods and goddesses of the Mediterranean, you will know that Artesia is the goddess of the spring. And it is said that where Artesia walks, spring water springs out of the ground in her footsteps. So this is To Artesia. I think of the river the way it reads in the Sam Shepard story, Cruisin' Paradise, a huge concrete serpent, a dumping ground for murder victims. I think of the river beside a freeway off-ramp as rollerbladers bent into it, spandex buttocks rotating, roll downstream. I think of William Mulholland's gentle, limpid stream coursing from a pharaoh's forehead or from the brow of a Rhine maiden, green-eyed and coffee-colored, a bracelet of drowned children wrapped around her wrist, descending from the mountains east of Irwindale into the Jardin des Rocas. The river is a rigorous mistress, but when you tickle her with your deeds, you can hear laughter from beneath her concrete corset. And that's true. I guess I should say, because this is somewhat of a commercial occasion, these are almost entirely poems from Dear Oxygen, which is a selection of about 40 years worth of ravings, teardrops, and songs of the South. Reading J.K., deep in the 40s hipster idea of the translucency of a San Francisco Sunday morning's windy sunlight, that flapping tragic overcoat's been tried on for size by many the hapless biographer and is now in the collection of one Johnny Depp, a handsome actor, followed by a poet desperate for his youth, his breath, the two men bent into the tippling morning bottle of Sherry Wind, the breakfast of ex-champions, not far from where the Griffith Park coyotes howl. Wilderness breaks out in the city. Its yippie choruses follow the two gentlemen into the changing station, drowning into the stream of traffic with its all-night scream of truck brakes shuffling back and forth across the continent like a bad intention. He'll do the benefit of the benefit reading, then get a blowjob from the breezes when the dogs howl and the neighbors scream, "Shut up!" Their words bracketed by old freeway ghosts rumbling up and down the I-5. Give me an I-5, because I thought all that while sitting on the banks of the Moon River watching Henry Mancini settling in the western sky above my George condo, listening to the violin player in the canoe plinking at the end of her red tether, thinking that someday streetlights will make this all seem Victorian. But it's raw now, raw as the city it drains. Everybody had to fight to get here for nature's blessing from the Tongva priest spreading prayer smoke with an eagle feather while a mother peacefully nursing her baby on a warm autumn evening stretches leonine along an inflatable mattress nestled in the broken glass, taking back the night. When water flows downhill to power, when water flows downhill to power, then money will line the all-American canal. and a handful of super-rich vampires will control this planet while you and me sweat out our frustrations and toil and self-pity. Does anybody here know how to play this game? Or is love just a given or a gift, a grace we never noticed or ever learned how to accept? I don't want to die like this. Rattlesnake Park. A dope deal goes down in the shadow of a sycamore. The rain washes across the parking lot, sweeping everything ahead of it into the storm drain. With his dollar cigars and his impenetrable shades, his sweat-stained towel and the shining conch, Lightning Hopkins was the lord of the Jacksboro Highway. I saw Jimmy Reed talking to himself in the bathroom mirror at Lou Ann's. Lonnie Johnson told me he could sing a hole in a goat's head if it had stand still long enough. Long have I worshipped at the Church of the Honky Tonk. It was the river bottoms that taught me to be wild. This is the voice of the river. The voice of the river is a red-winged blackbird twittering in the trash bags, festooned across the branches of a cottonwood like prayer flags. The freeways are louder than the river. The I-5, the 110, the LB overwhelm the river and its tributaries with their roar. But when the tributaries bring their gifts of rainwater to the main stem, the river can be louder than the thunder rolling out of the San Gabriels. The voice of the river is the golf ball clanking in the power towers and the kids on their bicycles laughing when they spot the mud people moving along the sandbars in silent meditation. I hear the river singing through the passing railroad cars, the screeching metal as a Metrolink commuter train tears apart. News choppers circle overhead, the howling ambulance sirens followed by the coyote pack's howl, the high-pitched chee, and the endless meetings, always one or two more, the laptops clicking, the TMDLs, the BMPs, the RFPs, the SAOs and the UAAs, the murmuring bureaucrats, the sharp whack of gavels, the deep voice of command, the swooping bats and swallows and swifts. I listen for them to make my own hearing more acute. The scream of a fishhawk, the flapping of 100 pigeons, and the rock doves too scatter in fear. A great blue heron's sorrowful honk, the trill and ripple of water moving across rocks. At the center of itself, the river is silence, and that's where I come in, with the sounds in my head and the words in my heart. And circling back around to where I started, for La in Sausalito, twice. I don't much like NCI, but you seem drawn to its creepy situations. A postmodern murderer dispatches his female victims live on the internet, watched by a coven of evil men. We agree that we both love The Office and 30 Rock, but The Larry David Show leaves us both cold. It's so slow. You keep searching the channels for a new episode of Hung, but there isn't one. There's nothing else on after that, but we could care less, because the delicate skin beneath your breasts draws both of our attentions as the tides roll in and in and in and in, gently rocking us as we rock each other through the night, as our ardor rises on the waves and the lights on the other houseboats twinkle like the stars. Thank you. So, oh, we're supposed to go over there.
situated. All right. Good evening, everybody. I'm Linnell George, and I'm really thrilled to be here. And I actually, I kind of sat there and listened all night. I'm honored to be here, actually, as I was saying back in the green room, because these are two people that I followed when I was thinking about becoming a writer. And I brought this book tonight, Poetry Loves Poetry. I was working in a bookstore and when I was in college, and the gentleman who edited this book, Bill Moore, came into the bookstore and said, would you guys carry this book? And I was a college student, and I said, I'm going to go talk to the manager and see if that can happen. And for me, for somebody who was trying to figure out writing and what it meant to be a writer in Los Angeles, this was sort of a map for me. And both Wanda and Lewis are in this collection. And this is, my mother had purchased Wanda's books, but this is how I was able to learn. She's in it, and about a lot of other writers. Lewis is in it. And how I got immersed in writing in Los Angeles. This was like my Bible. So when I moved away to San Francisco, this was always on my shelf. And I would show people, this is what we do here, too. So I just wanted to bring this tonight to share. First off, I want to talk about that community and trying to get to know one another. And I just was curious for both of you, just to get started. People talk about how it's difficult to have community here, especially community of writers. And I wanted to know how you two got to know one another. If you remember how you met.
In transit, right?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I mean, that's how it's done here. Yeah. Since L.A. doesn't have a plaza where everyone, the way New York or Chicago works, where people of like interests are drawn together. In New York, it's the Algonquin, and in Chicago, it's politics. People really talk serious politics in Chicago. You can't talk politics here.
Because you're not being polite. Being impolite?
It works differently here. I think that's indicated by the kinds of books that people buy. And we sell more books about recreation and dieting and how-to and popular culture books than any other kind of book, even though the Los Angeles audience is the largest audience of book buyers. Right. And that sort of says something about the politics, I think, is where the interests of individuals lie. But I was all over the map. I was very hot to trot. After I got left home at 18. So I was everywhere. There was something going on in terms of writing. It didn't matter whether it was Beyond Baroque Literary. I was Beyond Baroque Literary Center when it opened its doors in 68 or 69, or whether it was the Woman's Building, or whether it was the Studio Watts or Bud Schulberg's Watts Writers Workshop, or the
Bach.
Hollywood Writers
and Papa
Rest.
Weren't you?
Papa Box. Yeah, yeah, I was. I hung out at Bakke, and I was in some of the issues. After 20 rejections, I finally got work accepted in Bakke. But when Lewis came to town, whenever anyone comes to town, there's this. You know, I spent a lot of money on gas and postage, so I was crisscrossing. And I lived in my car. I would bring my children with me. And they would sleep. I would put them, Beyond Baroque had this big sort of pseudo stage, and I would lay them in the people's coats, and they would sleep while I was going to the workshop, because, you know, that kind of existence. So I was, you know, constantly traversing the cities to develop my skill as a writer.
I feel like Wanda has always been there like a statue out in front of a cathedral or something. I can't even remember when I didn't know Wanda, and I didn't even move to L.A. till I was 35. And so L.A. was more, I lived in Northern California for a lot of that time and traveled a lot and went to school in the East. And L.A. was just kind of an accident, really, for me. I mean, I wanted to be near my kids, and I wanted to make movies. I had met the filmmaker Wim Wenders in San Francisco, and like every schmo, I decided I would make it go into the movie business. And I wrote a lot of scripts, and I made a lot of videotapes, and you know, and found that I was much more interested in being a good journalist than I was in being a mediocre filmmaker. But I didn't really feel like L.A. was anything like my home, really. It was just an accident. I just happened to be there. And then when I saw the L.A. River, I was working on a CETA project, which was a work project during the Carter administration, where you get $3.50 an hour for leaning on your shovel. And I was walking, I was living in a guy's attic in Venice that had like a piece of plywood over the beams. And I taken the bus downtown for the CETA job. And one day I was coming back to the bus stop and I noticed the LA River. And it was just one of those weird moments in one's life, or at least it was the only moment like that in my life, at least so far, where I knew something, you know, and I knew that I was going to be involved in the LA River for the rest of my life.
Wow.
And one of the things, and then I'll stop, but one of the things that attracted me was not so much the river itself, but the possibility of creating a community or a network that had to do with the river and with changing Los Angeles. I always felt that LA was so horrible that it had to be the yin that had to come out of the yang.
Mm-hmm.
And the river is somewhat kind of an evidence of that, I would say.
So when you came to L.A., though, for what reason, though?
I wanted to make movies.
You just wanted to make movies?
Yeah, you know, I'd met this guy, Wim Wenders, and, you know, and I saw his movies, and I thought, oh, I could do that.
I can do that, too.
Yeah. But it turned out I couldn't.
I want to get back to that, because I want to talk to you about the documentaries. But first I want to ask both of you, I'm going to start with Wanda. How did L.A. begin to emerge in your work, you know, as a poet? Was it the physical, or was it you writing about what it inspired in you, some emotion?
I was an avid reader as a child. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was reading Shakespeare at the age of 10, and I spent many hours in this library, mm-hmm, having my father check out books that I would pull from the stacks because I wouldn't, they were adults only and I wasn't allowed to read them. And I read a lot. I mean, I would just clean the stacks. I'd read all the mystery books. I'd read all the science fiction. I'd read all the poetry. I'd read all the philosophy, whatever I could get my hands on. And I started A and worked my way all the way through the N. And for all the reading I did, the world I lived in didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't exist. And I'm looking at, you know, how come my world isn't out there? And, you know, there was this small bookshelf, like in the anthropology section, that had all the literature on it with African Americans, Latinos, American Indians, and there was this one little bookshelf. And I would look at that, and I knew some of the titles already because my parents had them, mm-hmm, Richard Wright's, for example,
right,
and James Baldwin. And I was introduced to a lot of poetry from the, on Sunday mornings, you know, along with the sermons, Langston Hughes,
right,
Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Right.
So I knew many of the black poets. And then my parents were very culturally aware, so I had a very rich cultural upbringing. I knew a lot about music and musicians, mm-hmm, who were African Americans and visual artists, but you could count the writers on one hand. And that's what led me to wanting to put what I saw in the world taking place, I wanted to put that into the books. I wanted that in the world. I wanted someone out there who might take an interest in Wanda Coleman's POV. you know, and so I was hot to do that. And that was the driving impetus. Mm-hmm. That was the force that drove me to write. After I discovered I wasn't going to be a concert violinist.
Yes.
Because of a bad case of encephalitis in which I suffered motor skill deficit, mm-hmm, and could no longer do the fingering that I needed, you know, to be a concert violinist.
Do you remember those first poems or the first, or were you writing prose? Or?
I was writing prose first. I started with stories, oddly enough. Poetry began to dominate because I was a working mother. And once I had a couple of divorces under my belt, I was working like crazy to support my children. So I would have to, if I wanted to write, I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'd get in 2 or 3 hours of writing before I had to jump in the car and drive from South Central to Westwood or the Valley, wherever I was working. And poetry was short. You could accomplish something if it was any good at all, you could accomplish it in a relatively short period of time, and then I could work on, you know, if I'm waiting to get my car repaired or I'm standing in line in the supermarket, you know, I could write a line down. I always had a notebook with me. I could write a line down when I was waiting at the stoplight. So I could always execute poetry. Well, that didn't demand as much quality time as the prose and the fiction. So therefore, over the years, my production went from about 80% prose and 20% poetry. It flip-flopped.
Okay. Lewis, how about you?
I forgot the question.
I know we were going down that river. I was curious about how L.A. began to emerge in your work. Was it the physical place? You were speaking so beautifully about the river and seeing the river. But I'm curious about how did it begin to emerge in your writing?
It's hard to answer that question. I got involved. One of the things that drew me to L.A. was a magazine called Wet, the magazine of gourmet bathing, which came out.
You have
of,
to tell them a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it was an incredible cultural event of the early 1980s and the end of the 1970s. It was a magazine that it really tried to bring together urban Los Angeles culture, pop culture, and Japanese pop culture at the same time. And I was able to get myself hired on for $300 a month to write all the articles, except for the interviews that Christine McKenna wrote.
Okay.
And all the resubscription letters and all the ad pages and all that stuff. You know, but I felt like I would have paid them. I practically did. That was kind of writing for Wet. It was Venice-based. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of gave, that's where I became based. I mean, when I arrived in L.A., I didn't know a single person. Mm-hmm. And I had, I think, $220, which had been loaned to me by a friend named Bill Nyman up in Bolinas, where I was coming from. And I got, my first day in town, I got a jaywalking ticket.
Oh, great.
And had to pay $200.
And so that was it.
That's welcome to L.A., sucker.
You know. Oh, God.
And you didn't hightail it out of here. I'm surprised.
I couldn't afford to leave.
So you don't remember then.
Well, I've been writing poems since I was a teenager. Yeah. You know? I mean, I'm sort of, my tragedy was too young to be a beatnik, too old to be a hippie. But I got way deep into the beats when I was a teenager and would write Jack Kerouac these long, what I thought of as Kerouacian letters. And, you know, not having any idea that he was, like, dying in Florida of alcoholism.
Did he respond, though, to any of them?
No,
none of them.
You know, but that was the mission that I followed was, you know, in the years that followed was Ginsberg and Corso and Frank O'Hara and, you know, all the poets of the great anthology, The New American Poetry, 1945, 1960. Right. You know, and the Lower East Side was happening then. And, I mean, the cultural center of my life. And poetry was something that I'd started doing when I was 15 or 16 and writing down the things I didn't want to tell the basketball coach. And, you know, and just kind of went from there, tried to be a great poet, you know, and tried, I mean, and that's still basically the bottom line.
Observing, keeping the notebooks and...
Yeah, you know, but it was mostly just trying to actually write, you know. I mean, it wasn't, I always felt like I wanted to actually write the poems, not write the preambles to the poems. You know?
Well, just like what Wanda was saying about finding time to write, getting up at 4 in the morning, did you have a writing routine, regimen, you know, at all?
I just wrote for a living, you know. Yeah, that's like it's what, you know, that's yeah. like that regimen then is imposed upon you. I never mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever taken a poetry lecture mm-hmm. class workshop in my no. life. Mm-hmm. You know, it just wasn't what was available to me at the time or was of interest to me. Mm-hmm. It was just the poems themselves. Yeah. That was the path that I've, you know, pursue poesy and leave a forwarding address, I think Ginsberg right. said one time.
Exactly. You know, Wanda, you were talking about, you know, publishing and sending things out and going to the post office. And but I also was curious about community. You know, as I mentioned in the beginning, like this idea about how diffuse it is, and you talked about meeting people in transit. Where were places that you felt at home, that you felt were touchstones, people who were encouraging, and not necessarily just in the writing community? What were the places where you felt, as an artist, you felt encouraged?
Hmm. Well, the musical side of me, Lynn Chandler and John Verhaney had a music workshop. I think it was on Tuesday nights. And so there were hangouts like the Bridge in Hollywood that was off of Normandy, I think. And I would go to these places, especially the Bridge, where after the main performance was over for the day, there were five women who were all musician songwriters who would gather by the fireplace, which was rather lovely. Judy Sill was one of them. I think she was originally Canadian. There was a woman named Natasha who pulled up roots and went to San Francisco. A woman named Shirley Grant, who was going to become my future mother-in-law. Bonnie White, who was the daughter of singer Kitty White. Kitty White is in the 1954 movie Riders to the Stars. She sings the theme song to that, and she was Elvis Presley's coach, singing musical. Elvis Presley's singing coach. So I was hanging around with people like that because there was still a part of me that wanted the music and the world of the music. I was also interested in theater and dance, and I was involved with Anna Halperin and the San Francisco Dancers Workshop. So community yep. for me became the people who gravitated around those centers. I mentioned mm-hmm. a number of them before, mm-hmm. the Watts Writers right. Workshop, Odie Hawkins, Emery Evans, a number of the first rappers. They did the first rap LP, came out of Los Angeles. Most people don't even know that. So there were those people who I hung around with on that side of town. Some people consider me a Venice poet because I was at Beyond Baroque so often, as it moved from building to building till its present residence. I was involved with that from the time the doors opened to around 1975. I was interested in the Alvaro Cardona Hine workshop. So I was basically a product of those kind. Diane Wachowski's workshop, Clayton Eshelman's workshop. So I was constantly that substitute. I could never afford an education, a formal education, to complete my education. And I learned very hard lessons when I entered the school system that they weren't giving up nothing to me. I was getting no game, and I was damned if I was going to pay for nothing. So I dropped out and went to where I felt people would feed me intellectually. Between my own reading and borrowing books from friends and relatives and acquaintances and spending hours and hours in the libraries, that's how I began to get my education, and especially at Beyond Baroque, listening to people talk about Pound or Duncan. And then I found my mentors as I went along. I found a mentor who happened to be a friend of Charles Bukowski. So I got involved with the Bukowskiites, I called them, these wild white guys who were running around Echo Park. including Paul Vangelisti was one of them, who's now over at Otis.
And then also in this book.
That's right. And so, and all of the people in that book, to me, that's like my college graduating class.
That's like your yearbook.
You know, I know everybody in there, you know, and in one way or another. And so as I went from these, you know, workshops, these became my peers. Mm-hmm. And we kind of began to mature parallel to each other and start to get books and start to become legitimized, and many of them started to become professors. And so I kind of grew up in this cultural net that I created for myself. But gas was 29 cents a gallon then, and I still couldn't afford it. You know, but I spent my, I would go days without eating. You know, I was constantly passing out from hunger. I would, save all the food for my kids, and I was just driven. And that's how I sort of created this community. And then I began, in the 80s, I think I met Lewis in Amsterdam. Then I began to travel with my work and began the End of the World stage. Right. But it started here with Bill Moore, Michael C. Ford, Jack Grapes, Holly Prado, Jim Crusoe, Bob Flanagan. These were the people I grew up with. Roderick Bradley, just to name a few.
How about you, Lewis, your community?
My community, and this is going to sound kind of weird, but because my oldest son, I'm incredibly honored that he's here tonight. And I think that, family has always been central at the core, but poetry and politics, that cusp, has always been what has driven and confused me and hurt me into song, as trying to reconcile these irreconcilable urges. And in a way, I feel like I should beg my children for forgiveness, for the kind of intensity and commitment this kind of work involves.
Right. That's beautiful. One thing I also noted tonight and about both of you, and then it made me think about, as I've been reading you both over the years, how much music is a part of your work, and not just music in an abstract way, about music and place. And both of you tonight, evoked scenes of music scenes here in LA. And I wanted to talk, we were talking a little bit in back about your music and the influence of music in your life, and I wanted to talk to you too about it. So let's start with you, Wanda, about, you mentioned the violin, but I've been to poetry readings where Wanda she's sung, and I got chill, went right through me. I wasn't expecting that. This beautiful voice comes out. Can you talk a little bit about?
Well, I had formal music training. My mother managed to scrape the pennies together to actually have me study with an Italian violin teacher who had come to the United States from Italy, Mr. DiPinto, and lived in Beverly Hills. And sometimes I would see him not far, it was walking distance from home. And then other times I would go to his house in Beverly Hills and study. That's where I started. I also had piano lessons. My mother played the piano, and she had lessons for all of her children. I got good enough to play for the church choir, which I also did, and all the old gospel pearl standards. And I also had formal voice training. I had that. I could read music. I think I can still peck out something on the piano if I'm so disposed and feel relaxed enough. That really makes me nervous, having to play something on the piano. I got to the point, I was starting in my teens to give music concerts, but when I realized I couldn't be great as a musician, I gave my mother my violin and told her to sell it. I couldn't.
How old were you?
Well, I was 14 when I gave it up.
Wow.
That was because I was still trying to recover from the illness that had come around my 11th birthday. It wasn't happening. I couldn't
fingering is very important, and I couldn't do the fingering anymore.
So to even have the instrument around was painful to you?
It was painful. And I've always lived with a piano until I finally gave my piano to my brother, who's continued. He's a piano teacher. He teaches music. So I finally gave him the piano a few years ago and gave that up too.
So not at all.
So the writing has become
the music.
If I'm so moved at any point in the, I might break into song. I like playing with that delicate space between poetry and song, the area that belongs to the troubadour. I like playing mm-hmm. with that the divide. So sometimes I will do that. I even have a what I call a patter or a rap, and you might hear it sometimes when I talk, and I'll go into mm-hmm. this, you know, kind of lyrical way of speaking, especially when I'm being a raconteur and telling a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It becomes another flavor in it.
Yeah, it does. Cities have rhythms. L.A. has a rhythm. New York has a rhythm. Chicago has a rhythm. If you're driving through Spanish Harlem and you hear the cacophony of all the different musics being played as you're just going through the streets in a taxi, or if you're in New York and you're in a skyscraper and you can hear conversations rising up mm-hmm. from the floors below, and you can hear them like they're, you know, like the television in the room with you. So every place I've ever been, if it's Oxford, Mississippi, where these places have rhythms, mm-hmm. and people move to these rhythms even if they're not aware of them. Mm-hmm. And I listen for these rhythms that define a place. And I have a pleasure of trying to get them into the writing itself. So I'm very sensitive to whether I'm in the Cheyenne, Wyoming, or wherever I happen to be, Amarillo, Texas, or, you know, it's there. It's almost atmospheric. And you could hear it in the traffic, the way people talk, mm-hmm. in the movement, the rustle of clothes. So I'm always listening for these rhythms and trying to, that's where some of the rhythms in my poems come from. Like the rhythm of the flow of the LA River.
But even tonight, it felt like, as you were reading, you were talking about going to hear jazz. And then you were talking about the honky-tonk. It reminds me of when LA radio, whereas you could turn the dial and you would hear so many different sounds, and which represented so many different communities here. How about you and music in your work?
Well, when I was growing up in Texas, I hated white people. And no, I mean, you know, I'm being facetious slightly, but I'm not also not being facetious. Because I grew up during segregation times, and I hated that. And I started listening to blues. I couldn't listen to white people's music. Mm. You know, later, many years later, I was stuck in Tel Aviv, and I found a Hank Williams record, mm-hmm. and that turned me on to white people again. But I mean, for me, music was kind of a political act, you know. I mean, I listened to the blues. I mean, the first record I ever bought was a Muddy Waters record, and that was, you know, it expanded. And I mean, those little notes of Lonnie Johnson and all that stuff—that was actually all that stuff is real. Mm-hmm. And I just followed people around and listened to the music and learned what they did. I could never play anything. But I was a DJ, and my youngest son actually is now, he goes to Occidental, and he's becoming a DJ. Yes, Doug Funny is what he calls himself.
He does.
Oh, that's...
You know, but I had a show on the college radio station called Lou's Blues, which I, you know, just played blues music all night long. And so it was really out of that, you know, and going into rock and roll and... Mm-hmm. You know, Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
That's funny, Louis, because... I had the kind of the opposite experience with my mother. My mother was from Hennessy, Oklahoma, and she wouldn't allow black music in the house.
Really?
So I was constantly listening to classical music, and country and western music. She loved Grand Ole Opry, so I knew all of it. And Patsy Cline. Oh, she didn't. She hated Billie Holiday, and she loved Patsy Cline.
Oh no.
Oh yeah! Oh, let me tell you, I can shit kick for days. I even my early dance lessons were square dancing.
Oh my God!
And my mother had me, you know, well, she's from farm country, so she had me in the 4-H club, you know. And so the only time she allowed black music in the house was on Christmas Day. My father could play his records, his 33 RPM. He could play his records all day long on Christmas Day. And when he did that, I was like, what is this? What's going on?
Who is taking over the house?
I mean, I was when I would go to the library here, I would go head straight to the music room first and put on Franz Liszt's Lay's Preludes. And I would wear that record out. I wore the grooves off that record. So when my, and you know, I'm wondering, well, what is this? Charles Brown? Who are these people? Bad Whiskey Made Me Lose My Happy Home? You know, what is this stuff? You know what? And then it was like my mother went to an AME church, and it was nice and quiet and, you know, relatively church. It was church and everything, and it was a nice experience. But my father was a Baptist, and when he'd take me to his church, or the Holiness Church, I said, what is, on the third Sundays with the call of worship, I'm going, what are these people doing? What is going on here? There's something here, and it's important, and I want to find out what it is, because somehow, you know, it's a part of me, and I need to understand it, especially the call of worship, when all of a sudden, people would rise and start going toward, you know, to become members of the church, and I'm saying, and I'm watching the choir, and they get into this rhythm, and they go, and then people start to, I mean, it was like magic, and I'm going, what in the fuck is this? And I started to have to, I mean, I, you know, I said, I had to investigate this. I had to find out what this was. Right. And I wasn't getting it much on the school ground, because when I went to school in the days of segregation, if you brought any black literature onto the campus, you could get expelled or suspended. Mm. It was contraband. Mm. Okay, people don't remember that. I went to school in the days, the beginning days of white flight, where all of a sudden the schools that were mixed race all of a sudden became black. And all my white friends and Latino friends got on the yellow buses and were driven away, and I would never see them again. Mm-hmm. And I used to, what is this? And so I had to, my parents didn't teach me anything about racism. All they taught me was that I was as good as anyone. And I was a good American, and I was equal to anyone, and don't ever let anyone make you feel inferior. Boy, that got me in a lot of trouble.
I'm going to ask you one more question to kind of roll off of what Wanda was saying, Lewis, and then we're going to open it up to questions to the audience from the audience. But then what was it like for you to come here after you left Texas and see L.A. and the way race worked here or didn't work here?
Well, I didn't get here until much, much later. I've told my friend, my fiance this, but coming to L.A. was like I recognized it from Dallas, because it was, which is where I grew up, because it was a place that motivated by greed. And I'd been living in kind of in hippie worlds for a decade or so before that, and always in kind of bohemian anti-war and movement. But L.A., there was this familiarity that I wished that I didn't know so well. But
if so, it was jarring, really jarring.
Well, it just...
Even though, I mean, it was familiar, but you had been through this other experience.
Yeah, though. You know, it was, I mean... L.A. is not really a character in my work. The L.A. River
is. The river is.
The river is, totally. But that's the geography of my own imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the city itself so much. I mean, but the river drains the city, so you can't... It's not like I've tried to avoid L.A. It's just I tried to keep, like, having the river flowing downstream to the sea.
Did you ever predict that this would become an avocation of yours? How could you tell that it was kind of beginning to overtake everything? You were drowning in it, as you were saying earlier.
Yeah, well, when I saw it, I knew I was going to spend the rest of my life involved with it.
Immediately. Wow.
I mean, instantaneously. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know why particularly, but it turned out to be the case.
Well, we're happy you have, because you've shown a light on it now. And have created so many different opportunities for us. Yeah, because of your work.
It's happening.
Yeah.
The river is happening.
Okay, so it's now time for you to participate. There'll be a microphone going around, so if you have a question, please raise your hand.
Hello. I've lived in L.A. my whole life, 49 years, and I feel like I've learned more about L.A. in the last hour than I have like in 10 years. And I want to thank you both for that.
Thank you.
Salud.
And my question was, Wanda, riffing off of what you said that every city has a rhythm. Every place you've been has a rhythm, Oxford, Mississippi, and et cetera. But what is then the rhythm of L.A.? And also to Lewis, you know, as poets, you know, you try to capture in verse a feel of the city, its ethos, its rhythm, its cadences. What is for you the rhythm of Los Angeles? What distinguishes the rhythm of this city from other places that you've been?
Styx Hooper, I think, composed an album called Wine Light. And there are sides on there that just sound like L.A. when I was in my 20s. Listen to that LP. That's the closest I've heard musically of what this city sounds like. I think Grover Washington did the music. I'm not sure, but the album, you can Google it to figure out what it was. But Styx Hooper and Grover Washington really got that sound for me. If I could translate it, Eddie Harris. If I could translate it, there was a pianist by the name of Dorothy Donegan, who. Captured it, so I can identify. It's easier. I think his name is Charles Wright. The Watts Rhythm Street, yes. 103rd Street Band. Yep. I'm a Crip Dog. Da 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 da. Also, there's this. You know, you can't dismiss the fact that's influenced me. Our juxtaposition to Mexico. That's a part of the city too. That's a part of the rhythm here. There's the music, the African-influenced music that comes up out of Mexico and Central and South America that we have that juxtaposition to. I was fortunate enough to be steeped in that culture when I was in junior high school. And so those rhythms for me, especially when you're in downtown and East L.A. One time I was coming across the border into Los Angeles, and I had this yellow head wrap on, so I was stopped and asked where I was born, and I said, I was born in East L.A., and the guy just laughed and just waved me on, you know. So if that answers your question, I can identify it by pointing out those who have captured it in music. There's a more contemporary group does that song "The City of Angels" that I like? I can't. The Red Hot Chili Peppers, you know. So there are people who have come along, and for me, have translated the sounds that I hear into music, and that's the easiest way to define it, I think.
For me, it's got to be X, the album Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
That's what was happening.
Yeah, Johnny Hit and Run Pauline. Yeah. Yeah.
Wanda Coleman, I saw you last time in 1982 at the Fifth Street Circuit Theater.
Where are you?
I'm over here to your right.
Okay. Okay.
It was 1982, I believe it was, that I saw you, and you had just won an Emmy for writing, being a member of a soap opera team of writers. And I was wondering, you know, since then I've been, you know, every now and then I ask myself, I wonder what happened to Wanda Coleman, because I moved back to Mississippi that year, and I'm just visiting here now. I've been here for about two months, and I'm going back in another week. But I was wondering, what happened to your your career as a scriptwriter for that lousy soap opera that you were working for.
And so go the days of our lives. Yes. Well, I was the last hired and the first fired. But I went on. I did have a screenplay option, and when Robin Givens, there was a cop show. Hollywood's really a beast. It is the worst. You know, you think you're in and then you're out, or you think you're out and then you're in. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. It's miserable. But I have done a couple of pilots, scripts for series that have not emerged, you know, gone anywhere. So one being that cop show that Robin Givens was supposed to star in, and I think it went 2 or 3 episodes and was canceled because it was so ludicrous. You know, it's very hard to educate Hollywood people because they think they know it all, and they don't have any, you know, where I come from, they don't have any lexicon for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, really do not. And so it is very tough to communicate ideas in that realm, you know. And I just got tired of beating my head up against the wall and walked away from it. Every now and then, someone will pull me, or I'll think, oh, I'll give it another shot. But it is beyond difficult. You know, one, racism isn't sexy. That's the first thing you're told. People tell me things like, oh, well, Wanda, now the civil rights movement is over. We don't have to be nice to you blacks anymore. One woman nearly drove me crazy, calling me at 2 and 3 in the morning to tell me about her love affairs with black people. You know, I need some sleep. You run into all sorts of psychoses and things that, you know, it is so beyond the casting couch. When I was doing the soap opera, oh, they were trying to set me up. They didn't want me to show up on the set because Granny was hot in the day. So I was kept off of the set so the men wouldn't see me. But they, at the same time, they were busy setting me up with the black actor that starred on the show, thinking that should be my boyfriend. You know, it takes over your whole life. It's unbelievable. And you really work hard. I would work, when I was doing this office, I would work, it eats everything. It eats you. I was working 10 hours a day for 16 days straight. And then I'd sleep for 4 days straight. And then I'd work again for 16 days or 10 hours a day. So it was really, really demanding. It's these people in that business, they really earn their money. I mean, they, you know, it drives you. You know, I pity the fools.
Question for you, but I was listening to in both of your readings, beautiful, beautiful readings. You know, when Lewis said, you know, coming here from Dallas, that, you know, you recognize the greed. Well, you both that stratum of greed is there in both of your work, and I wonder if just each of you could say something about the poet's role in kind of hammering away at that, or I don't know, hammering's not the right word, but can that poetic voice, your voices are both so important. How are the ways they get out there in the world so that they can make a difference? Because they are.
A wing and a prayer, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't have any secrets, you know, in that sense, especially. I mean, you just open your mouth and words come out. You know, I mean, I think that's what, you know, poets are word slingers, and you know, that's your responsibility in that sense is to be true to the words you're putting out. You know, and so. You can't afford to tell any lies because they'll definitely come back and bite you in the ass. You know?
Oh, When somebody, I have had a couple of people I didn't know call me at 3 o'clock in the morning to tell me that my poetry saved their lives, mm-hmm. that a poem of mine that they read or a story of mine that they read had helped them get through a tough time. I had a cousin, even in a family situation, attempt suicide, and I wrote a poem for her, and she lived another 25, 30 years, long enough to get to know her grandchildren and die of cancer. So those kinds of, to me, that's the real money. That's the real money. And I think it's tragic. This is, to me, this country is upside down culturally. When I go overseas, I'm an ambassador. I represent my nation. I am important enough to be interviewed on major television and on radio programs. Here, I don't exist, except in meager forums, you know, isolated places. But when I go overseas, it's totally different. People want to know about Katrina. People want to know, you know, about whatever important issue is being talked about in the day. They want to know about, they ask my point of view about, say, someone like President Clinton or President Obama, whoever. They want any insights that I can offer is of value, because this country is constantly being studied. And even people in poor, destitute areas, they have more political savvy. It's shocking. They've paid more attention to us than we have them. And so as a poet, and poetry is important in these places. Poets are at the top of the culture. Poets are revered. Poets are honored. But they can't afford to buy your book. They photocopy everything and pass it out and memorize things. You know, you're the tribal spokesperson. You're important. Here, you're practically valueless. If you don't have a dollar sign in front of your name, forget it.
I just want to say I don't feel that way at all about that, on that subject. You know, I think your voice is a gift, and you use it. You know, and what other people think, anything anybody else thinks, extra kicks.
We're at the moment. Well. Thank you all for coming, and if you enjoyed yourself this evening, you should think about, and you learned so much about LA, you should think about joining, becoming a member of the Library Foundation. But thanks, this was really fun. I really appreciate
it.
And you, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Lewis.
Yeah.
Thank you, Linnell.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.